Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
These are extraordinary times, and they're dangerous times. But here's the good news. In 2 months, we have the chance, not the certainty, but the chance, to restore some semblance of sanity to our politics. Because there is actually only one real check on bad policy and abuses of power, and that's you. You and your vote.
President Obama has come out of political retirement. There he was in Illinois today delivering his message for the midterms. And you can expect more of the same tomorrow when he comes here to Orange County. Democrats have made no secret of the fact that they hope to take over Congress this election cycle. And to do that, they will have to flip seats currently held by Republicans, 7 of them right here in California. Obama will be appearing tomorrow with the Democrats gunning for those seats. KCRW's Jenny Hamill has been covering some of those races. She joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us, pollster Paul Mitchell, vice president of Political Data, Inc. He's going to talk about—
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. He's going to talk about the big picture. But first of all, I want to get your reaction to Obama coming out of, political retirement in a sense. He's not made comments about Trump until now. What does his presence do for this election?
There are actually potentially good things and bad things for Democrats here. Focus on the good things that could come out of this for Democrats is once he steps foot in Orange County and joins a stage with their Democratic nominees for Congress, all of whom don't have experience in Congress. They haven't been major electeds. They don't necessarily deliver this immediate gravitas of somebody who can, you know, share a stage with a president. He can deliver that to them. He can make the story coming out of his Orange County visit about how candidates like Katie Porter went from being kind of an upstart campaign to sharing a stage with the president of the United States. And if he can leave with that elevating of the candidates, and if he can also help motivate some of the most unlikely voters in that district, and when I talk about unlikely voters, I'm mostly talking about millennials, Latinos, people who are more of renters and lower socioeconomic status, if he can deliver them in terms of getting them to turn out, that would be beneficial. The potential negative effect is that right now, Democrats are really prospering in an environment where essentially it's Trump versus Trump. And in that environment, there's really no upside for Trump. But if it becomes Trump versus Obama, it actually could help to serve to motivate some of the Republican voters a little bit more and maybe give Republicans a kind of permission structure to get out and vote.
Although in this particular district and in many of them in Orange County, we're talking about the 45th here with Katie Porter challenging Congresswoman Mimi Walters, the Republican. That district went for Hillary Clinton in 2016. So that wouldn't necessarily be the case that Obama would be a negative motivating factor for Republicans.
Well, I think there's two little caveats to that. One is, yes, Hillary won that district in 2016, but it was a binary choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and all the controversies that Donald Trump brought. Right now, we're talking about whether or not the contrast between Mimi Walters and Katie Porter is the same as the contrast between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And I would argue that that's actually less polarized. And then the second thing is that the environment in 2016 in that general election had extremely high turnout. And we're talking turnout in the 70s, mid-70s, 75-78% in some of these parts of Orange County. And I don't think that even the most enthusiastic political watchers are expecting presidential level or higher than presidential level turnout in the 2018 gubernatorial cycle.
Okay. Jenny, let's bring you in because you talked to the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which is organizing this Obama visit.
Right.
What do they see happening? Why do they want him to come, and how do they see him possibly helping their cause?
Well, exactly what Paul was saying. They realize that they need voters at the level of the 2016 presidential election to get any of these Democratic candidates through. They appear to be super confident. They point to the fact that analysts say of those seven congressional districts that Hillary won, about six of them are in play. They're toss-ups or better. So that might seem optimistic to some, but that, at least that's what the DCCC is saying. So by bringing Obama in, he is, you know, in their perspective, the antidote to Trump and kind of the long lost hero of the Democratic Party. They know that it will galvanize the base, maybe get some young voters out there that might not go out and vote during the midterms. But they also say when you look at California and you have a large swath of non-party preference voters, now the second biggest voting bloc in California ahead of the GOP voters, they think that there are some people in the middle out there that are looking for a rational voice, someone that is an alternative to the, you know, anonymous op-eds we're seeing written about the president's immorality, and that they might be persuaded to vote for a Democratic candidate.
Paul, do you think the DCCC is being too optimistic, too hopeful when it comes to these seven races? Do you think they're all flippable?
No, I think that there are a couple that, you know, like example, the 49th. When we look at that district, the total sum of all the Democratic votes in this 49th, which is the district formerly held by or currently held by ISA, of the total votes in the primary, there are actually more votes cast for Democrats than Republicans. And that's the only one of these competitive congressional districts where that was true. So I would say there are some districts like the 49th where they look very, very competitive. There are other districts like maybe the Valadao seat in the Central Valley that doesn't look as competitive. And so there's essentially a range. If you would think that there's these seven districts and, you know, there's a good chance that Democrats could pick up a few of these. I think that's fair, but to think that all seven are going to flip, I think is a little bit too much.
Jenny, I want to talk about one in particular that's really interesting, demographically speaking. Okay. This is the 39th, so kind of inland from the coast, south of L.A.
Right.
And so this is Orange, L.A., San Bernardino counties. Like, so this amalgam of three different counties. Ed Royce retiring from that. And the candidates in this race are the Republican Young Kim, mm-hmm. who is Korean-American, and Gil Cisneros is the Democrat, famously winning a huge lottery jackpot, which is funding.
Quarter of $1 billion. Who wouldn't want to win that?
Funding his race in large part. So, but this is a district that is rapidly changing, 20% Asian.
Yeah, that's right. So 1/5 of the registered voters in the 39th are Asian. And it is interesting to have two candidates who are minorities. You know, kind of historically, when we thought about Orange County, we thought of it as a very kind of white area. But a lot of people are talking about the fact that in this midterm cycle, there is kind of a sleeper voting demographic that they're trying to galvanize, whether it's on the Republican side or Democratic side. It's a lot of the Asians and Latinos who are living in this district and growing. So Young Kim, Korean American, I was just on Twitter this morning and there was a guy who said, I got to meet Young Kim. And if she wins, it's a win for all Korean Americans. So kind of leading into, you know, is this about issues or more identity politics? Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of Koreans in that district, Chinese in that district, and yet you have Gil Cisneros. You know, he was this Frito-Lay's manager, kind of suddenly, you know, got this opportunity with a bunch of money to run for office and donate to USC and things like that. But, you know, speaks to kind of the Latinos in the district as well.
Yeah. Paul, what do you see in terms of what the voters want? Are they voting strictly on party preference or the issues, or are they looking at identity politics as well?
Well, I would say, first off, it's primarily going to be based on party and ideology that people are voting. We do see, particularly in Orange County, a lot of racially polarized voting wherein, let's say, Janet Nguyen, who's a state senator in the area, she will get overwhelming votes from the Vietnamese community. Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter. There is a kind of a lockstep vote for Vietnamese candidates among the Vietnamese population. And that can be true among other Asian ethnicities. When you look at this district, we have, I'm looking at the numbers, 28,000 Chinese, 14,000 Koreans, 12,000 Filipinos, and then it gets down to other, 6,000 Vietnamese voters. The challenge is for anybody trying to target this Asian community twofold. One, that the Asian, there is not a pan-Asian voting bloc. The Asian voting that is essentially this bloc voting would happen within individual nationalities, mostly. And secondly, there is a huge partisan divide appearing between older foreign-born Asian voters, particularly Chinese and Vietnamese, who are the core of the Republican Party in Orange County and have this kind of anti-communist focus based on their own personal and family histories, and then the younger U.S.-born millennial Asians who are extremely progressive. In fact, the under 35-year-old U.S.-born Asians are one of the most progressive communities in the entire state. And so we've talked about this in other places of the country with ethnic populations, but as they get to second and third generations, you can see situations where the grandparents and the grandkid couldn't agree on a single political issue.
Hmm. But will young people go to vote in a midterm?
Well, if the DCCC gets their way, then those young people will turn out. If the DCCC gets their way, a combination of this enthusiasm with the president coming, the kind of stress and anxiety around having what's happening nationally, the fact that every TV station, radio station, podcast, newspaper in the county is focused on this race, and their mechanics, the turnout that they're doing, the texting, the phoning, the walking, that all of that will combine to an environment where they will get record turnout from these populations. And if they do, that's what's really going to put these districts into play.
Jenny?
Yeah, I mean, to speak to that, I was just down in the 48th district.
This is Dana Rohrabacher's.
That's right.
District.
That's right. So I was hanging out with some canvassers for Harley Ruta, the Democratic opponent. And the guy who runs the precinct, he's taking a gap year before he goes to Harvard. He's half Vietnamese, 18-year-old. And he was basically telling all of these middle-aged people, here's our message, yada, 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 teaching them how to use the app to walk around to the various homes in the precinct. But he spoke to the fact that as a half Vietnamese person who can speak Vietnamese, there are different messages that he has for the younger Vietnamese and the older. And he kind of spoke to the generational differences as to what's really important for the older generation. He said human rights. There's kind of memories of what happened in Vietnam. And with younger people like himself, the environment, just making sure that women have protections over their bodies, things like that were messages that he was giving to them. So that was interesting.
Fascinating. Paul, listening to President Obama speak today, this morning, I was really struck by him mentioning Medicare for all. This is not something that he talked about necessarily while he was president. In fact, he was fine. He got rid of the public option in a compromise to get Obamacare through. Does that surprise you that he's now talking about Medicare for all? This is something that until recently only Bernie Sanders talked about.
No, I mean, the Democratic Party has been moving in this direction fairly fast, especially in California. The entire state of California has been moving really rapidly in this direction for years. The fact is that I believe those that are doing the strategy around the Democratic turnout really are hyper-focused on getting these young people to vote and connecting with issues that they care about. And I believe they've made essentially a calculation that something like this might get out, an additional, 2 or 3% of Republican votes. But it on the Democratic side, it might get out another 6 or 8 or 9% of Democratic votes. So I believe they're making this calculation essentially that the best way to win in these races is to just seriously focus on motivating your base.
Paul Mitchell, Vice President of Political Data, Inc., and KCRW's Jenny Hamill, thank you both so much.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, so it's time for a break for some movie reviews. William Bibbiani co-hosts the podcast Canceled Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed. Hello.
Hello.
And Russ Fisher is editor-in-chief of MoviePilot.com. Hi.
Howdy.
Well, first up, a Jennifer Garner action thriller called Peppermint. She's a woman who wakes up from a coma after her family is shot in a drive-by. Her husband and young daughter are dead.
Mrs. Norris? I'm very sorry for your loss.
We have three suspects in custody, but they're all linked to the Garcia cartel.
No witnesses have been willing to step up.
These cartels are no joke. They've got everyone in their pockets.
You've been through a terrible tragedy. Maybe you didn't see what you think you saw.
That's him.
Maybe you've made a mistake.
Okay, so she plays a character, Jennifer Garner, there named Riley North, who then has to enact revenge.
Yeah, her family is killed. The system, the legal system, fails her because it's corrupt. And she goes off on like a 5-year Batman training escapade and comes back now a total kick butt action hero.
She's all ripped and wearing like muscle tees and
And she plays the part well. It's important to remember that like Jennifer Garner, like her first big breakout role was in Alias, and it seemed like she was going to be this huge action star. And then for the last like 10 years, she's been relegated to these really bland, forgettable mom roles and stuff like The Odd Life of Timothy Green. So from a Jennifer Garner perspective, Peppermint is actually quite cool because it is her mission statement saying, I kind of should be an action star, and everything she does in it is quite good. She is a believable, cool action star. The movie itself is somewhat irresponsible.
Somewhat irresponsible.
It's extraordinarily.
She's just a one-woman killing machine.
Well, she's a one-woman killing machine who is facing down the most stereotypically Latino gang, like MS-13 looking gang that you've ever seen. A bunch of the movie takes place
like they have tattoos on their faces.
They have tattoos on their faces. Yeah. A bunch of it takes place on Skid Row in LA, and it's like, this is an area that represents a gigantic problem for Los Angeles, and you're setting action scenes there and stuff. It's just gross. The movie's got no imagination. It's like it was the thing that was in a coma and woke up 5 years later and didn't remember anything. It's so run-of-the-mill.
Why
it doesn't
is it
have
called
a point
peppermint?
Of view.
Because her daughter ordered peppermint ice cream once.
Oh.
Moments before she was
killed.
I
was hoping it was Peppermint the drag queen, but anyway.
Unfortunately, no. That is one of many things that could have made this movie a lot more entertaining.
Some drag queens.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Yes.
Okay, let's move on to I Am Not a Witch. This is about a young orphan named Shula who is taken to a witch camp in Zambia.
Is that it? Exactly when is it going to rain?
Shula, how are you settling into your new life?
Do you like to take a picture with me? Look at the camera.
No.
I'll send it to you.
Okay, Russ, what is this movie about?
This movie is about Shula, an 8 or 9-year-old girl who is accused of being a witch. And like many other women in the movie's version of Zambia who are accused of being witches, she is sent to essentially witch prison, where these women are segregated from society. They wear ribbons that connect to these spools on poles so that they can only travel so far. They're effectively the property of the state. And so the allegory of suppression of women and control and superstition is all very present. It's kind of a surreal movie. It's not a plot movie. It's more, what is this girl's experience as she is going through this process of control and ultimately manipulation by a state official who basically realizes he can make some money off of her.
Oh, wow. Okay. So does she have any supernatural
Well,
properties?
It's open to question.
It is because, ironically, every time they ask her to do something like, okay, one of the people in this village stole this man's dowry. Who did it? And she happens to pick the right person. Maybe that's a coincidence. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not. The movie, it's funny and terrifying at the exact same time. And it ultimately turns everything into this really potent fable. Like, I really love this movie. And there really isn't anything else like it in theaters right now. And you should see this.
It's the work of a first-time feature director named Rangano Nyoni. And she creates these images that are absolutely
Zambian?
Gorgeous. Yes, she is raised in Wales, but born in Zambia. Hmm. And the images she creates are wonderful. She really uses the visual potential of the ribbons connecting these women to a tether in terrific ways that are absolutely evocative of this sense of control and this sense of ridiculous superstition, as you're talking about. And then in the trailer, you heard the music, which kind of gives it the air of almost the, I think the closest thing would be the movies of Yorgos Lanthimos recently. So a film like The Lobster, or, you know, his movie The Favorite is at festivals right now. And it's that sort of...
So it's a little surreal.
Surreal, strange, but like you said, potent and very... Yeah.
It's directed. It has a target, and all of its absurdity, all of its humor, even if it seems just odd, is entirely directed at a really valid concern and place. Politically, from some form of sexual politics, all of it. It is one of the most hard-edged films of the year, and yet it's funny.
Okay, next up, something similar. This is a Netflix documentary about women living in Eastern Congo. It's called City of Joy.
The powerful countries of the world are funding militias. The militias use rape as a weapon of war.
Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of women raped and tortured.
All the survivors, what do you think they do? They leave. So we ask all these women what they need.
Russ, you saw this one. It's a community of rape survivors and volunteers who help them. And these women stay for 6 months and, yes, and get the help they need physically, mentally.
They're taught leadership skills. They're taught to live with themselves. They're taught to live with what they've experienced, which is universally horrible. As that clip suggests, there's stories, constant stories in this film of incredible sexual violence and abuse at the hands of militias and people who are fighting this kind of ongoing civil war in Congo.
And what's interesting here, these militias are fighting for control of these areas that have these natural resources,
correct,
these minerals that these companies use to make cell phones, for
yes,
example, like Apple uses yes this stuff.
And that's a big part of the text of the film, is the idea that this is a manufactured conflict, effectively, as companies are hiring militias to represent them, to represent their mineral interests, and then those militias are committing atrocities. And then the cyclical nature of that, which is when you start to see, you have generations who have seen atrocities committed in front of them and nothing has happened. What happens to those people? What do they grow up having respect for women, for families, for community?
Hmm.
And so this doc is really about City of Joy, which is an organization that tries to help these survivors come into their own, to recognize their value, to learn to move forward and to learn to be leaders. And it's powerful. There's nothing in the film that's surprising. There's nothing about the film that is unusual. It's very talking head sort of doc. But these stories are just overwhelming.
Yeah. And it's an issue nobody probably thinks about when they open up their phone and know that part of it is
correct
connected to what's happening to these women.
Yeah. And that aspect is a relatively small part of the film, but is emphasized in a way that's very effective. And in the whole of the film really does talk about the fact that this is a conflict that a lot of people in the West know nothing about.
Hmm. And do you feel like it's hopeful at the end, or
hopeful throughout? That's the wonderful thing about it, is that it is hopeful throughout, and it's uplifting, and it is. You see all of these women who are at City of Joy, and you see them really openly supporting one another and laughing and dancing, which is not to minimize what they've experienced, but it does represent an attempt to move forward and to build something new.
Okay, last up, the complete opposite, a horror movie. This is the Conjuring spinoff called The Nun.
I had a series of visions when I was younger. And after each one ended, the same thought would be stuck in my head.
What did you see?
I saw a nun. Word of my visions reached the church, and I was asked to accompany a priest to an abbey in Romania.
The Abbey has a long history.
Valak.
Not all good.
Okay, so their sister Irene, played by Thaisa Farmiga from American Horror Story.
Mm-hmm. And sister of Vera Farmiga, who stars in the other Conjuring movies. The Conjuring is building into this really large kind of interconnected horror universe, and it's really kind of fascinating to watch. That being said, although you may be dedicated to the franchise, if you skip this one, you will be none the wiser.
I see what you're doing there.
Thank you very much. It took me a long
time
to come up with that.
You're here all day. Okay.
This movie is, you know, we're used to the Conjuring movies being quite scary. Even Annabelle, the kind of the worst one before this, attempted to be genuinely scary. This one is kind of goofy. This one feels like a really broad, comic booky, kind of dumb movie about people going into a medieval castle and fighting a nun.
Is it scary?
No, not even close.
No jump scares, nothing like that?
Lots of jump scares. Most of them don't even work.
What was terrifying is watching this movie, I wondered if I was having some sort of breakdown because I was like, I can't possibly not understand the nun. And yet it's so incoherent. It's so inconsequential that I saw it with a couple of friends last night and we walked out and looked at each other and we're just like, what even happened there? There's no story. There's no character. I hated this movie.
The marketing campaign is scarier than the movie. Yes. That's not good. It has kind of a fun atmosphere. And I will say this. It moves quickly. Like, look, the food isn't good, but at least there isn't much of it. So, like, this is a pretty huge step down from, like, Annabelle Creation and the other two Conjuring movies. And it doesn't even feel like part of this franchise. It feels like a rogue spin-off of like the Crow movies.
It feels like, have you seen those drunk history videos?
Yeah.
It's like the drunk history of
but not funny.
The Conjuring, but not funny. Mm-hmm. Save your money, wait a couple of weeks, get a ticket to the Haunted Hayride in Griffith Park, and it's the same experience but more honest. And a lot more fun.
Just rent Annabelle Creation again. That one's good. Like, there are good movies in this franchise. I'm sure the franchise will survive. But, it's a really great, scary image, this nun. But the story they got to go around is this weird combination of Tales from the Crypt, Demon Knight, and Michael Mann's The Keep. Two great tastes that don't taste good together. Also, one of them isn't great.
Okay, so basically it looks like we're going to Africa this weekend if we want to see a good movie.
Please, I Am Not a Witch is wonderful. And it's only opening in a couple of markets. It's not a big movie. I think Film Movement is putting it out. And it's one of those things that could easily be overlooked. And it was, you will remember it. That is a movie that will leave a mark on you in a good way.
There's a really good chance it's going to end up on my best films of the year list. Like, it's excellent.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, at least we got one. That's good. William Bibbiani co-hosts the podcast Canceled Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed, and Russ Fisher is editor-in-chief of MoviePilot.com. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Coming up.
I don't think you'd necessarily want to be me. It's very hard to turn it off. It might sound great if it's turned on, but what if it doesn't turn off?
The difficulty of being Elon Musk. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, smoking weed, wielding a flamethrower, and a samurai sword. That was Tesla CEO Elon Musk on Joe Rogan's podcast last night. The entrepreneur talked about all kinds of things, LA traffic, the end of the universe, virtual reality.
When you're in that virtual reality, which is only going to get better, where are you? Where are you really?
Right.
You aren't anywhere.
Well, where is...
You're in the computer.
Well, the interview has a lot of people wondering what is going on with Elon Musk. This after talks of privatizing his company and then saying he wouldn't privatize his company, the erratic tweets. Now two senior execs at Tesla are leaving the company. The stock is down around 9% today. Ryan Mack is a tech reporter for BuzzFeed, and he recently had a pretty heated exchange with Musk on email. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. So you emailed him about this story involving a diver he accused of pedophilia. This is during that whole Thai rescue story couple months ago. What is this all about?
I think we've gone through like a Mad Libs of like things that he's done, even through that intro. But this incident happened. There was the Thai cave rescue of that soccer team that got trapped in Thailand. And Elon got involved, tried to build a submarine. The rescuers didn't like that. One of them criticized him. He didn't like the criticism. He called him a pedo guy, a pedophile in a tweet. He apologized. Fast forward, he then reopened that with another Twitter kind of argument saying that the guy was a pedophile, or suggesting that he was again. And I inserted myself somewhere in there after he was threatened with a legal threat from this rescuer's lawyer, asking him what he thought about the situation. And that's kind of how that whole email situation started between me and him.
Yeah. And it was like on the record, but he kept saying it was off the record.
Yeah, we were going back and forth, and then at some point he declared unilaterally off the record, which I didn't agree to, and so we decided to publish that email after he sent it to me.
Just for the record, is there any evidence at all that what he's saying could be true about this guy?
We actually looked into it. We took some time over the weekend to call the Thai Immigration Office, call the UK Embassy in Bangkok, talk with this guy's long-term partner in Thailand, and for what we could find, there's nothing that could substantiate what Elon was saying.
All right. Well, let's go to that Joe Rogan interview. It was filmed on camera, and you see him, you know, partway through, lighting up.
So is that a joint? Or is it a cigar?
Yeah, no.
Okay.
It's marijuana inside of tobacco.
Oh, okay. So it's like posh pot, tobacco,
yeah.
Posh.
You never had that?
Yeah, I think I tried one once.
Come on, man. You probably can't because of stockholders, right?
I mean, it's legal, right?
It's totally legal.
Okay.
How does that work? Do people get upset at you if you do certain things?
Okay, so then you see him just smoking weed, which is legal in California. So is that a big deal?
I guess you have to ask his shareholders. I don't know. I mean, this is after, of course, he said he was going to take his company private at the price of $420, $420.
All right.
And so you get this weed illusion. Now you actually have him smoking weed. I think for shareholders, it all looks like a distraction, I guess. And it's not the fact that he's smoking weed. It's the fact that he's doing all these things, going on an interview, doing this for 2.5 hours. I think that's a little worrying for some people.
Right. So meanwhile, he's behind production, right, to produce the Model 3 Tesla. And are people wondering, well, why isn't he focusing all of his energy on that?
Yeah, I mean, they've missed their production goals for the year, and they're trying to get back on track. They've built a couple more assembly lines up at that Fremont plant. But yeah, I mean, he's given interviews where he said he's working 20-hour days or some absurd number of hours at the factory. Yet, I guess he still has time to go and do these bizarre interviews with Joe Rogan.
Yeah. Well, another thing you talked about, which is of interest to us here in L.A., is this idea to solve L.A. traffic with tunnels. So he has this company, this other company called The Boring Company, and this is how he described it on Joe Rogan's show.
It's sort of a hobby company called The Boring Company, which started out as a joke, and we decided to make it real. And dig a tunnel under LA, and then other people asked us to dig tunnels, and so we said yes in a few cases.
Okay, so is this a joke or is it real? What is happening with this?
Oh, it's very much real. I mean, they've started digging. The idea, of course, is to build tunnels underneath large cities so that people can travel through those thoroughfares, I guess. And they have demo videos and such. And I think they're building one to Dodger Stadium. But that's the idea. Drill holes through the ground, build thoroughfares through that and help solve traffic. And it's his third company that he's working on concurrently with Tesla and SpaceX.
Mm.
So, yeah, that it's funny because he said he started as a joke and now it's a very real thing.
Yeah. Well, repeatedly, Joe Rogan asks him, how do you have the time to do all this stuff? And he didn't really answer the question. How does he do all this stuff? Or is this the problem, that he comes up with all these incredible ideas and then doesn't maybe see them all the way through while he then focuses on another idea?
I think his biggest critics will say that this boring company thing might be a distraction. His biggest supporters will think, like, well, he's trying to solve another massive problem. And you get this kind of like, how is he balancing his time? And when it was SpaceX and Tesla, he had this kind of great balancing act where he would spend time at one company on one day and time at another company on another day. And now you get this third kind of element going in there. But I mean, that was always that's one of Elon's biggest strengths, I guess, kind of being able to juggle all these things. And you're kind of starting to wonder if he's getting stretched too thin now. I guess there's a lot of issues going on, so
yeah,
we'll see.
So these two executives who left today, what does that tell you?
With Tesla, I mean, news organizations have kind of kept a running tally of the people that have gone in and out of that company over the last couple of years. This is just the latest of that kind of merry-go-round. One of them was a chief accounting officer who I believe was only there for a month, which is never a good sign when someone goes in and turns around and walks out the door. The other person was their chief people officer, essentially their head of human resources, that was on leave, and I believe she said today she wasn't coming back. So you can read into that what you will.
Right. Well, finally, I want to play one last clip from that interview, which is kind of Elon pondering his, I don't know, existential self.
I don't think you'd necessarily want to be me. It's very hard to turn it off.
Yeah. What's the hardest part?
It might sound great if it's turned on, but what if it doesn't turn off?
Now, I showed you the isolation tank, and you've never experienced that before.
No.
I think that could help you turn it off a little bit just for the night. Yeah. Just give you a little bit of sleep, a little bit of perspective. Like, you must have, like, a constant stream of ideas that's running through your head all the time.
So he says, yeah, that's pretty much it. I do. And I came away from that interview thinking, like, this guy is incredibly bright, so smart, and his ideas are so interesting. Maybe, though, he's not cut out to be a chief executive of a company.
Maybe. No one's denying that Elon's, like, incredibly bright. But there's always been this mythos around him that he can do everything. And at what point he's human. He's still very much human. And we've seen that in interviews. He gave one of the New York Times recently where he broke down a little bit. He talked about using Ambien to help him get some sleep. Like, there are limits that Elon Musk has. And I think that was a very truthful answer, I guess. It felt like I was listening to like a patient and a psychologist right there.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's interesting to see inside the mind a little bit.
Right. Ryan Mack is a senior tech reporter for BuzzFeed. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Within days, millions were infected. Within weeks, they were forced together.
Containment is our absolute priority. Blockade all bridges, streets, and rail links.
And then left to die.
The apocalypse, fun for a weekend matinee. But up in Silicon Valley, some of the richest people are getting serious about planning for the end of it all. And their location of choice, should everything go south, figuratively that is New Zealand. They're investing in bunkers buried 11 feet underground, among other things. Olivia Carville wrote about this for Bloomberg. She's a tech reporter there, and she's a New Zealander. Hello.
Hey, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right. So you spoke with a few 1%ers or 0.00001%ers. What are their plans when it comes to relocating to New Zealand?
So what we do know is that in the last 2 years, there have been at least 7 Silicon Valley executives who have purchased and installed underground survival bunkers in New Zealand. At one particular dinner party, the conversation got quite detailed, and one executive talked about specific plans where he has a moped scooter in the garage of his home containing a go bag filled with guns, and he intends to ride his scooter through the traffic on the way to his private plane in East Bay, and then he intends to fly that plane to a hangar in Nevada where a Gulfstream G550 jet is awaiting, which he co-owns with a number of other executives from Silicon Valley, and they intend to fly to New Zealand.
What is doomsday in their minds?
From what I understand, they largely mostly fear biological warfare, nuclear war, a biological bug or virus that could spread and kill food crops, or an uprising that would target the 1%, a revolutionary-style uprising, I guess. The fears are real and cemented throughout Silicon Valley. I think that within the Valley, a lot of people are working in AI, and they're coming up with technological advancements, and they are then looking into the future and saying what's coming next, and a lot of fear comes out of that.
All right, so New Zealand, that is their country of choice. It's pretty far away. Why New Zealand?
Well, as a Kiwi, I'd have to say I might be slightly biased there, but New Zealand is isolated. It has an incredible kind of natural beauty to it. It's one of the best places to live in the world, as I would say as a Kiwi, but it's also a safe haven. It's a refuge. New Zealand is an enemy of no one. It's got a population of 4.8 million, and it's a Western democracy. It's progressive. It's got good health systems. It's a great place to be if you feel like you need to escape from disaster or turmoil occurring elsewhere.
So they don't think any of that disaster or turmoil would touch New Zealand?
Oh, I'm not exactly sure. That's hard for me to answer because I'm not really sure. The individuals who have purchased those underground survival bunkers, we don't know their identities, so I haven't been able to speak to them personally about what they think. But I have talked to a number of people who do build and manufacture these bunkers, and they have raised the point that maybe New Zealand isn't the best place to be, particularly, say, if an asteroid hit in the Pacific and it resulted in a tsunami which could actually submerge the entire island nation.
Oops.
So there's kind of been conflicting reports as to whether New Zealand really is the best place to go.
Right. So how do the New Zealanders feel about this?
I actually put that question to our former Prime Minister, John Key, while I was reporting this story, and he came back and said he thinks that Kiwis would find this both crazy and amusing. I also raised the question with Immigration New Zealand officials who said that they think that Kiwis would likely get a bit of a smirk on their faces when they hear about these doomsday preppers planning to flee to New Zealand. In response to the story that came out yesterday, there have been some people writing on Twitter, how do we return these bunkers to the sender? So I think it's kind of been conflicting, the response. Some people think it's a bit of a joke, and other people think it's quite alarming that we have doomsday preppers planning to flee to New Zealand and making multi-million dollar investments in the country, but underground.
Yeah. Well, short of these kind of extreme bunker scenarios, lots of rich people are building houses there. I understand that there has been some kind of legislation that is trying to curtail that a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. The Investor Plus visa in particular has seen increasing rates of applicants. In the 2017 fiscal year, it received about 17 applications. And in order to apply for that visa, you need to be willing to invest 10 million New Zealand dollars into the country over a three-year period. And that gives you the ability to then go on and get residency. And in response to all this, the New Zealand government felt like they needed to come up with a way to kind of curb foreigners coming in and purchasing these popular properties. So that law is set to take effect in coming months, but it doesn't ban foreign ownership outright. It allows foreigners to still buy new apartments in large developments, but it just means that existing homes are off limits to offshore buyers.
Okay, getting back to the apocalypse. So let's say that happens and these seven Silicon Valley executives manage to escape into these bunkers, then what happens? Are they the ones who are going to rebuild once the dust clears?
Well, that's a really good question. And I'll actually stop before we even get to when the dust clears and just raise a point of to actually get to New Zealand is one thing, but then they actually have to find the bunker, which raises another hurdle, because these bunkers are built 11 feet underground and they're built completely in secrecy. And once they've completed and installed the bunker, there's nothing left behind, no door or anything. So I asked him how these owners are going to be able to get inside the bunkers, and he said that they've been provided with GPS coordinates to find the entrance way to the bunker. And so this means that once they arrive into New Zealand, however they plan on getting there, they actually have to find the rural property that they've buried this bunker and then use their GPS coordinates to track down the entranceway to even get inside it.
Okay, so lots of ifs there. I mean, once the apocalypse happens, those satellites might not be fully functional for the GPS.
Yeah, that could be a problem here.
Yeah. Well, I can't believe they haven't thought about that. It's always the details, the really little details.
It is the little details, and it also depends on what apocalyptic scenario you fear the most.
Yeah.
Because if you fear, say, a revolution-style uprising in which the masses go after the 1%, they're going to have time to get onto their private planes, to fly to New Zealand, GPS will still be working, and they'll be able to locate their bunkers. But if we're talking about an asteroid or any kind of natural disaster, is New Zealand really the place that they want to be? I don't know. I was there in 2011 for the Christchurch earthquake. You know, we're prone to seismic activity and we are an island nation that is at the bottom of the world. So I'm loath to say which is the safest place to go, but I'm not sure if it is New Zealand.
Right. Maybe there is no safe space at all. Maybe we're all doomed. Olivia Carvel, tech reporter for Bloomberg, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for us here at Press Play for this week. Our producers are Sarah Sweeney, Christian Bordahl, Amy Tom, Michelle Aloy, Yael, Evan Orr, Alexandra, Sif Trigvadottir. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. We had engineering help this week from Phil Richards. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a fantastic weekend. I'll see you on Monday.